Welcome back to Innovation on Dakota Midday. I'm Kara Hetland, and we're going to spend some time coming up hearing about some chemistry research. We're also going to hear about the state wrestling tournament and the innovative way that South Dakota Public Broadcasting is bringing 800 matches online, live streaming over 2 days. So it's some cool technology that we'll talk about coming up. But first, we're going to talk about a clinical trial happening at Samford. And joining me is Dr. Chad Spanos. He's a physician at the Samford Ear, Nose, and Throat Clinic and a scientist at Samford Research. And welcome to Innovation. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you. Pleasure.
So let's talk a little bit about your focus is on head and neck cancers.
Correct. And okay. Specifically HPV positive head and neck cancers.
Okay, so the human papilloma virus, right?
Yes, the same one that causes cervical cancer, but it also causes head and neck cancer.
Head and neck cancer. Okay, so talk a little bit about the clinical trial.
So the clinical trial is asking a question of, can we use immune therapy or immune modulation to try to clear some of these cancers that are caused by viruses? So it's not just looking at HPV positive cancers, but looking at other cancers throughout the body that are caused by viruses. Okay. And so the trial basically uses a immune modulator and then trying to assess response to that immune modulator to see if some of these cancers will go away.
Okay, so we're talking about a virus that there is a vaccine for, I have to say.
That's correct. And if people had been vaccinated 30 to 40 years ago, we wouldn't be having this trial right now. But these are usually cancers that we think happen quite late from when the virus is actually acquired by someone.
And is this a sexually transmitted virus?
Yes, for cervical cancer. For head and neck, there's still some controversy in that area, but most people still think that there's a strong component of sexual transmission.
Okay, so talk about what this cancer is like in head and neck. What are we talking about?
Yeah, so for head and neck, it's mostly in the tonsil, so the area where kids have their tonsils removed, and also in the back part of the tongue, so an area where it's really hard for people to see it. And it might start as a lump. You might feel like you can't swallow as well, maybe some pain back there. But most people, unfortunately, do show up with a large lump in their neck. And that's the first sign that they have the cancer, and it's already spread to the lymph nodes in their neck.
Oh, okay. So is it a tumor?
Yes, it's very much a tumor. It starts out as a tumor in the back of the throat, and then it tends to spread to the lymph nodes in the neck.
Okay, so we're talking that then the trial, the experiment, is that you're going to try and muck up the immune system to turn around and fight the cancer.
Right. And so this is something that, you know, the idea of the immune system fighting cancer has been around for a very long time. And there was a period in the 1970s where people tried to do this and it didn't work. They didn't have the right agents. And then recently in the last 15 to 20 years, scientists have figured out that there's these called checkpoint inhibitors, but it's essentially the brakes on the immune cells. And if you block these brakes or take the brakes off, then the immune cells can go in and kill the cancer. And so that's exactly what this trial is trying to do, is to apply these agents that we know can remove the brakes from the immune system and to see if the immune system alone is enough to try to kill the cancer, make the cancer go away.
And what are you finding so far?
So far in this trial, I do not have any preliminary results for you, but using this same drug, there was really good signal in these types of head and neck cancers. And when I mean signal, we had some patients that actually responded to the drug, and for chemotherapy or drugs alone, we actually had some patients where the cancer went away and stayed away. And that is very unusual, and that is making the cancer community very excited that these drugs have the potential in some patients to actually cure them. And so we're really excited about this trial. This trial is mainly designed as a safety study. Is it safe to give this drug to this class of patients? And then also trying to learn some more about the biology of the response to the drug. So looking at the tumors, looking at the response to the tumors from the drugs.
Is this a type of tumor, a type of cancer that you can really target and get the genetics out of it to really focus? Are we talking the same language?
We are talking the same language. The genetics of head and neck cancers have been looked at. Unfortunately, there's not a driver gene, kind of like with breast cancer. You know, you see BRCA or some other things like that. There's many different mutations that are present within these head and neck cancers, but there's not one common target that you could send a drug after to try to block that would make the cancers go away. So instead of focusing mostly on targeted treatment to these genetic mutations in these cancers, people are backing off and they're now starting to look at other ways to make them going away, including immune therapy.
Okay. And so otherwise, treatment is just chemo?
Treatment is chemo and radiation together.
Okay.
If you come in with a very small tumor, then surgery is an option. And so, for example, in this trial, just to give you an example, someone walks in with a head and neck cancer. They can be treated with the drug, and then we wait for around 3 weeks. And then depending on how big the tumor is and what we call stage, you might end up receiving chemo and radiation together to treat your cancer, or you might end up having surgery and then maybe needing radiation after that.
Okay, so paint the picture of what the ideal candidate for this study looks like.
So the ideal candidate for the pre-treatment or the cancers that haven't had any other treatment before is either a patient who shows up with head and neck cancer. You have to have tonsil or base of tongue cancer, or cervical cancer or some of the other GYN cancers also would be eligible. And then there's other groups where we're looking at people who have already gone through treatment and now unfortunately they have the cancer come back. Those patients would be in the more metastatic setting and they would just receive the drug alone. And so this is a really nice option for people who have had treatment before. Now they have the cancer back. They've already tried some other chemotherapies. Maybe they didn't work. If they're eligible, it would be a good trial for them.
Is there that level of fear of what if it doesn't work for me and I could have done something else?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, what are the things you have to think about before you join a trial like this when you have cancer?
And unfortunately, yes, those are strong considerations of the side effects of the drug. And since this is a newer drug, we're in that early phase where, you know, we think we know what all the side effects are, but we don't know everything. And from a cancer patient standpoint, unfortunately, you run out of treatment options pretty fast when you're in that recurrent metastatic setting. And so just to generalize, I'd say most of our patients, unfortunately, don't have the luxury of saying, maybe I'll choose this other one instead of this treatment. It's, boy, I sure hope that I'm eligible for this trial and I hope it works for me, because there's usually not a lot of competing clinical trials out there for people in that setting.
And then do you have the blind trial where you may have the placebo?
Correct. And so the way these trials usually work is that first you start with safety. So you try to say, is this going to hurt people? Are we going to be able to give this and it's going to be safe? And then after that, the next, which is phase 2-3, is when you actually look at, is this as effective, more effective, or less effective than what we consider standard of care treatment? And that is the randomized blinded trial. So we're kind of more in the early setting right now.
We're in the safety right now.
Correct.
Okay. And so what are some of the side effects?
So some of the side effects are rare, and they've learned more about them, but you can have what's called pneumonitis or a inflammation of the lungs. Basically, they're almost all related to the body attacking itself. So you can have inflammation of the thyroid. You can have some kidney problems. You can have some nerve issues where the body's essentially attacking the nerves. All of these side effects are fairly rare. And now that we know that they occur, we tend to catch them very early and we can treat with steroids, stop the drug. And so, yes, there have been some life-threatening events or deaths, but those were more in the early studies, you know, a year or two ago. And now that they have this aggressive intervention and staged response to these symptoms that happen, it's much less likely.
So you monitor?
Monitor very closely, yes.
Okay. And is it an IV infusion? Is it a
IV oral? Infusion,
okay.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. How often?
Usually every 2 weeks is how it's dosed right now. And that's for the people in the metastatic setting. For the people who walk in, what we call treatment naive. So you have the new diagnosis of the cancer, you're noticing that it's there, you haven't had any treatment before, those people are actually receiving just a couple infusions, and then you wait a period of time, and then you actually do your treatment. So asking very different question in that setting.
Okay. And how many people are you looking to enroll?
So this is actually a international study sponsored by Bristol-Myers Squibb. And so each group has targeted for around 25 to 30 patients. And so some of the groups have actually already filled. So for example, some of the metastatic GYN cancer, such as cervical or vulvar cancer. Anyway, some of the other groups have actually already filled. But that's the target number, and that's all based on statistics saying, out of this many people, how many side effects would we expect to see? Can we reliably detect those side effects in that group of people, and then let's stop and let's analyze the data and make sure that we aren't hurting people by doing this drug.
Okay, and then you go to the next
phase. Then you go to the next phase, that's correct.
And then at what point then does it become a standard protocol?
And that's up to the FDA, but usually the FDA to say that what you're saying is an indication. So to say this drug is indicated to treat this cancer, that usually does require that next step, which is showing efficacy, showing that compared to what we would normally pull off the shelf to help people with cancer, that you can use this drug instead, and it hopefully you would show that it actually does a better job with less side effects. And that's really what they're hoping for. But yes, that's what's required, is these larger randomized trials to show efficacy. And then you get an indication from the FDA to say you can use this.
And so we are years away.
We are years away. Okay. Yes.
And so you, as a scientist and as a physician, how do you, knowing what you know and what you're looking at here, how do you treat your patients now, knowing that that's out there?
That is really difficult, because we work in the research lab out at Sanford Research. We have animal models where we're looking at HPV positive cancer. We have a very good idea of what we think the immune system is capable of and the different combinations of treatment that we can apply in that setting. However, you still have to keep in the back of your mind that this is investigational. And we took an oath to do no harm. And part of that oath means not turning patients into experiments unless it's under a standardized, rigorous protocol of a clinical trial. And so you have to compartmentalize all that exciting new information that you have and these things that you really want to try out, and push them to the back of your mind and say, okay, this is what the evidence is. This is what I have indication to treat. And so we apply what are called National Comprehensive Cancer Center Network guidelines for the treatment of patients with head and neck cancer. And then whenever possible, we try to enroll people on clinical trials to try to answer some of these important questions. And the trials are really a nice option for patients, because they give them access to newer drugs that we think are really going to be helpful at an earlier phase than waiting for those years and years and years to have them maybe become approved, like you say, 5 years from now.
How eager, though, are people to do this?
Around here, and this is the beauty of the upper Midwest, we just have wonderful people around here. People are very altruistic, and most times when approached to participate in a clinical trial, people say, well, if it could possibly help someone else, and of course the trial has to be well designed, so it seems like there's benefit to them, but most people are very supportive of participating in clinical trials, and we have a very high rate of, once people are approached to participate, that they do agree to participate, and they also follow through, and they do what is asked, and so it's just a wonderful place to do clinical trials, because people really want to help other people
more so than themselves.
Yes,
really,
that's the impression that I get now.
Okay,
I'm not a psychologist, so I haven't gone in and tried to tease out all the motivations, but yes, no, people seem to really want to try to give back, because I think they realize that cancer is just not a singular event, that it possibly will affect their spouse or their grandchildren, someone else in their family. And so while they are struggling and dealing with the cancer at that time, they're also looking around and saying, this is affecting many, many people that I know and interact with.
Because we're a little more selfless here than perhaps other parts of the country?
I would like to think that.
Okay. Okay. So how common is this type of cancer?
So if you're looking at the head and neck cancer, the HPV positive head and neck cancer, that is only 30 cases per 100,000 people per year. So not very common. If you add in all of these other viral-caused cancers, then the numbers are actually quite large, especially if you include some of the early HPV-positive cervical cancers or precancer-type lesions.
You know, so really what I'm hearing is you know, you hear this genetic space, this is the way to focus, this is the way to focus, and now I'm hearing this is immune. So you really have to understand cancer itself to know which is best.
Correct. And
to
And I think the research community is really struggling, or it's a race to see, is it going to be genetics? Is it going to be immune system response? And it's probably going to be a combination of both. But what happened was, as we started to get technology where we could actually look at the genes and look at the mutations in the genes, we found a few cancers that were actually driven by mutations. And there were a few drugs that came out that worked spectacularly well against those mutations. And so that led to an explosion in looking for more mutations, trying to do targeted treatment. And unfortunately, that so far has not been a huge payoff for a lot of the other types of cancer. And so now the immune system is kind of rising up as a interesting target, a promising way of trying to treat these cancers. Only time will tell to see if it's going to be immune response only. Is it going to be a combination of targeted treatment plus immune response? Mm-hmm. Too soon to tell.
And the word I think that scares me more than cancer is that it's virus driven.
Yes.
And that scares me.
Yes, because no one wants to get a virus, so we don't like getting the
that
flu.
That means it's contagious, right?
It is very contagious. Uh-huh. And with HPV, everybody, the natural thought is, well, I've been good and I haven't been exposed. But we know doing studies that almost 85-90% of people have actually been exposed to HPV. And so what actually is the differentiator is your innate immune response when you actually were exposed to HPV, and did you clear it and your immune system blocked it and made it go away, or did it actually stick around and cause cancer? And so it's a scary thought, but most of us actually have been, you know, exposed throughout our lives. And so where people are also trying to focus on is not just a prevention vaccine, but once we know that people actually have these viruses, are there therapeutic vaccines that we can give to go in and try to clear out the virus or the after effects of the virus?
Are there other viruses that cause cancer, or is HPV the only one?
No, absolutely. There are many other viruses.
Many.
So, yes. There's something called Merkel cell polyomavirus that mm-hmm. could cause a rare type of skin cancer. And then it's not as frequent as much in the United States, but more over in Asia. Another example is Epstein-Barr virus, and that can cause a type of it's nasal cancer. So it's in the very back of the nose called nasopharyngeal cancer. That one also causes lymphoma, and it's also another cancer that is on this current study causing stomach cancer driven by this Epstein-Barr virus.
Hmm. It scares me. I'm just going to be honest. It does. Okay, so the next step, you're still enrolling patients?
We're still enrolling patients. Okay. The trial is still open, and this is called a competitive accrual trial. So what that means is it's an international study. Okay. There's only so many slots for each type of cancer, for each type of indication, and so when those slots fill, the study is done. And then they follow those people. We look at the results and the data, and then the company and the investigators decide where to move next. So right now, there are still slots open for the recurrent metastatic HPV, the gastric cancer, and also some of the GYN cancers in the not the metastatic setting, but the first mm-hmm. line treatment setting.
And how many sites around the country, around the world?
Around the world, I think there's 30 to 40 sites.
Okay. And yeah. One of them is?
One of them's here.
Here.
Yeah. So okay. This is really, you know, South Dakotans should be proud that they
cutting
have
edge.
Access to yeah. cutting edge trial. Yeah.
Okay. And so you'll come back and let us know when you learn more?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Be happy to.
I look forward to it. Thank you so very much for coming on the program today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Chad Spanos is a physician at Sanford Ear, Nose, and Throat Clinic and a scientist at Sanford Research.